Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, UC Merced has big plans to expand, but state budgets are tight. How will the campus double its capacity over the next few years? We'll talk to Chancellor Dorothy Leland and find out why she hopes the private sector will build, design, and even operate the new facilities and save the campus money. We'll also hear the latest on the Rough Fire, which is now over 20,000 acres near Kings Canyon National Park east of Fresno. We'll talk to the folks at Hume Lake and find out how that community is dealing with the blaze. Right now, though, we turn our attention to something that's been in the news a lot lately, and that's El Nino. Of course, we don't know if it will cure California's drought, but in places prone to flooding, officials are already prepping for the worst. FM89's Ezra David Romero reports on why officials hope to dig deep to prevent flooding and restore the aquifer.
National Weather Service, Cheryl, may I help you?
At the moment, the mood is hopeful at the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Hanford. A strong El Nino could bring storms to our dry part of California. Meteorologists like Gerald Meadows are looking to the sky for signs of what his peers say could be the El Nino of El Ninos.
The million-dollar question is how strong the El Nino is actually going to be. Most of our forecast models are indicating a strengthening.
Even though this could be the strongest El Nino on record, exactly where storms hit produced by it are up to debate. Dependent on circumstance, Central California could receive a significant amount of rain and snow. But even if one variable is off, then precipitation could mainly stay in Southern California, leaving out the most parched regions of the state.
Assuming the track of the storms shifts south, as we typically expect in a strong El Nino, we could see more moisture, more storms moving across us, but those storms still have to develop and get brought across the jet stream and into our area. Assuming those do, there's potential for heavy rain.
That heavy rain can mean heavy flooding. That's why officials in places like Fresno are doing something you wouldn't expect in the middle of a drought, digging holes in the ground to store water in order to prevent future floods. Fresno has over 160 ponding basins and canals connecting them. You know those sunken grassy community parks that fill up with water when heavy rains fall? I'm at one of these sites with Alan Hoffman.
So we're at what we call Basin BS off of Fowler, just south of Mill Ditch.
Hoffman's the general manager for the Fresno Metropolitan Flood Control District. Right now there's no water here. A backhoe is filling up semi-trucks with 10,000-gallon containers full of soil, so if heavy rains happen, this basin will be able to collect runoff from surrounding neighborhoods. They want to make the basin bigger. Right now the basin could hold 60 acre-feet of water, but when the digging stops, it'll have a capacity of 300 acre-feet. That's like five times bigger, kind of like going from a swimming pool's worth of water to a small lake.
And so we got an excavation program going on right now.
The thing is, most of these storms' water management basins only hold about 6 inches of rainfall collected over a 2-square-mile span. The problem is it takes time for that water to percolate back into the ground, restoring the aquifer underneath the city. So if the region is hit by back-to-back storms this winter as a result of the looming giant El Nino that's predicted, then places like Fresno could be in trouble.
Anytime we get more than the 6 inches, if the basin's full and we get a rainstorm, the only place for it to go, if we can't get rid of it soon enough, is it'll start filling up neighborhoods wherever the lowest part of our collection system is. And that's happened on, you know, a number of occasions.
That's why the flood control district Hoffman manages is working around the clock to make sure these ponding basins are at the right depth and have fully functioning pumps.
We obviously listen to what weather people are saying about the magnitude of the potential for the storms, but it's not like I can change my system instead of taking 6 inches to take 12 inches. It is what it is.
Hoffman would like to see a new standard when it comes to the depth of these basins. He says a standard of 8 inches of capacity in all 160-plus ponding basins would be ideal to avoid flooding. He remembers the aftermath of the last few big El Niños.
They talk about the 83 El Niño and the 97 El Niño, and during that time, our system was very challenged. Ponding basins were full, you know, it's filling up in neighborhoods, and we're just trying to find places to move the water as quick as we can.
Even with those concerns about flooding, he's still optimistic about El Niño. He just hopes it doesn't veer too far south.
El Niño that affects the southern half of the state isn't going to be as effective as something that would hit the entire state. I would hope that first the El Niño pattern hits the Central Valley.
A wet season in the region means fuller reservoirs and possibly a larger snowpack. If the state's lucky to get both, we could witness the first bit of relief from this 4-year drought. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And joining us now in our studio to talk more about El Niño, its potential effects on the valley, and more, we have Sean Boyd. He is a meteorologist and a lecturer at Fresno State's Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning. Sean, welcome to our program. What, when you hear the word El Niño, what's the first thing that comes to your mind as a longtime Valley meteorologist who's been through a few of these things before?
I cringe.
In a good way or a bad way?
Well, it's kind of mixed because I think the important thing is to try to eradicate any incorrect perceptions that the public has about El Niño. Just because we have a moderate to strong El Niño being detected where it occurs, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, it doesn't mean that we're going to get a pile of rain and snow in the wintertime. There's no guarantee. There are other things that are involved. So I don't know. I suppose maybe it might be a good idea to just, unless it's already been done already, lay out the basics of what El Niño is.
Yeah, exactly. We hear about warm ocean temperatures.
Right.
How is that different this year versus others? And what exactly are we talking about in this case?
Okay. So in a scientific sense, El Niño has only been studied for about 65 or 70 years. This is a phenomenon that occurs at random intervals, at 3 to 7 year intervals. So you can see already there's some randomness in this. What this means is that the ocean temperatures, the sea surface temperatures near the equator in the Pacific Ocean, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean near the equator, warm up more than usual. And sometimes that anomalous sea surface temperature increase extends eastward to the tropical eastern Pacific Ocean against the west coast of South America. And in particular instances when the El Niño is relatively moderate to strong, sometimes that abnormally warm ocean water can creep northwestward along Middle America's coast and then into the southern part of North America's coast. So scientists have a family of satellites up in the sky that are constantly measuring how deep in the ocean the warm water goes, how warm the water is, constant monitoring, especially the National Weather Service and NASA, NOAA together work on this to, first of all, recognize whether or not one is occurring, and then second of all, try to project into future months how long it's going to last. So it's an abnormal warming of the Pacific Ocean near the equator in the middle of the Pacific, sometimes stretching to the west coast of South America. That's the basic definition.
So that's one thing that's going on. Mm-hmm. But another thing that's been going on and influencing the drought and our weather patterns is also this thing that's happening up north, the ridiculously resilient ridge.
Yes.
And this the blob. I'm mm-hmm. hearing about that. That's
okay.
Not El Niño, but it's also something that's going on in the ocean. Is that
correct?
About right?
And that may be related more to something which is known as the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation.
So okay, I'm not going to ask you to explain exactly what that is.
That's okay. We'll try to get into it a little bit because it's El Niño is not the end-all and be-all here.
Okay,
just because
okay.
There's a moderate to strong El Niño, and there is, and it has been officially noted by those in the National Weather Service that put out a once-a-week bulletin about the status of El Niño, that this is a strong El Niño. There is also a circulation known as the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which and it's currently in what we call a negative anomaly. The idea is, the big question is, and Dr. Bill Patzert of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is a part of NASA down in Pasadena, had an excellent presentation just last Friday night that I watched. I streamed it last night to sort of get up on this, is whether or not the moderate to strong El Niño we now have will kick the PDO from a negative anomaly, which usually means we have dry weather in the winter, to a more positive anomaly, which then can displace the jet stream in such a way that we get more frequent and bigger storms at this latitude, Central California in North America. So that's the big question on everybody's lips. And even he didn't have an answer for that. There are people at MIT and Stanford and Scripps Institute of Oceanography and NASA Goddard and NASA JPL that make their entire 30 or 40 year careers just studying these things. So it's quite complex. So we have El Niño to take into effect. We have the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which needs to be factored in. And then we have something on a shorter term that sometimes happens, which is called the MJO, the Madden-Julian Oscillation, which is a 2 to 3 month cycle. Sometimes it occurs in the equatorial Pacific that can have an effect on storms that may or may not come into California by way of these very narrow concentrations of highly saturated air, which you may have heard of called atmospheric rivers, that will dump a ton of rain on one part of the state and leave the other part of the state almost completely dry.
And we've seen that in recent history.
December 2014. The only reason why we had any decent rainfall in any month this past winter, especially in Northern California, is because of an atmospheric river that slammed into northwestern California and southwestern Oregon for about a week and a half this past December. So even in years that are generally dry, we can get these events that seemingly come out of nowhere, these ARs or atmospheric rivers that are very, very focused on certain parts of Northern California, which could leave Central California, not getting a whole lot of rain. But December was decent, but that's the only decent month we had. The problem with the atmospheric rivers is they often come from the subtropics, which means our snow levels are higher, which means that even though the water content of the snow higher up above the tree line might be pretty good, that means precipitation, which normally would fall as snow, say in places like Shaver, would fall as rain. And then that sort of upends the entire timing of how we distribute water through our artificial plumbing system, if there's any to distribute.
And then that also is a concern that's magnified by concerns over climate change.
Yep.
And, again, the mix of precipitation in California. I'm thinking back to about this time last year, Sean, and
yes,
I remember people talking about El Niño. And, in fact, even in recent months, some in the State Department of Water Resources and the State Water Board have said, they think that California's conservation efforts last year, last winter, even maybe this spring, were maybe not as weren't as big as they could have been because people were holding out hope that this El Niño was going to come. We heard about El Niño last year, and it didn't really pan out. What's different this year? Is it just that much warmer in this part of the ocean?
Okay, here's the key. Yes, the sea surface temperatures in the middle of the Pacific near the equator in this area, which is known as Niño 3.4, it's a region where sea surface temperatures are monitored constantly with satellites. That warming is stronger than it was last year at this time, and computer models strongly suggest that this strong El Niño will carry into northern hemispheric autumn and northern hemispheric winter and might even to some extent carry into the early spring of 2016 off the west coast of North America. This was not the case with a developing El Niño in the spring of 2014, which basically fizzled out in the late summer and early autumn. The key is having that warm water around at the right place at the right time in northern hemispheric autumn, northern hemispheric winter, so that it can appropriately displace the jet stream being the river of air above our heads that steers storms from one place to the other, to displace the jet stream in such a way that we get frequent and beneficial storms when we need them and when we want them. We're very picky in California. We want our water when we want it, and we want that snow level to be the way it's supposed to be. And if we don't, then we, we complain about it.
So thinking about how El Nino influences the precipitation we get in Central California,
yes,
both in the valley and in the mountains, I think it's safe to say from what you're telling me and what we hear throughout the public is that an El Nino itself does not equal a wet year.
That is correct.
Is there a flip side to that, though? Is a historically a really wet year associated with an El Nino? Are there wet years that are not El Nino years?
Wet years in Central California, wet winters, I should say, are not always associated with El Niños. It just so happens that very strong El Niños did occur in 1982-83 and 1997-98, which did bring Fresno what ended up being its wettest and third wettest rainfall seasons in history so far. In 1968-69, there was also El Nino, but it wasn't a strong or very strong El Nino. It was a weak El Nino. And that, up until the June of 1969, that was Fresno's wettest season on record. The very wet year we had in 2010-2011, which is our most recent very wet year, where water content of snowpack was as high as 175% of historical average, and Fresno ended up with its seventh wettest season on record, 17-plus inches, 2010-2011, just a short few years ago, that was a La Nina. Okay. We only have two instances which have been measured in the last 65 years, which is basically a time frame we've been scientifically been looking at El Nino or ENSO, only two instances in which very strong El Ninos have produced wet winters in California. And, you know, statistically speaking, I mean, that's not much to go on. So that's why, just because there is an El Nino present and all the models strongly suggest it's going to carry into the fall and into northern hemispheric winter, which means us, we're in the northern hemisphere, there's no guarantee that we're going to have a wet winter. For all you people out there listening, whatever your worldview is, you know, whether you pray, you do a dance, you know, whatever it is, you know, do whatever it is you're going to do. But you know, it's going to be when it's going to be. And nobody really knows for sure. Will one very wet season in California end the drought? Heavens no. Look, in order to take care of our surface water needs, because of the lack of surface water, we've been pumping the aquifer, and we've been essentially mining that water for decades. And that water is thousands of years old, and it's not going to come back in our lifetimes. So this is a serious natural event that behooves all of Californians to, first of all, not point the finger at different constituencies and come up with sound solutions based on the best science and engineering we have, and to use water much more wisely than we do in California to sustain, you know, our standard of living.
Fascinating discussion, as always, with Sean Boyd, a meteorologist and a lecturer at Fresno State in the Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning, longtime weather expert here in the Valley, talking about El Nino and California's drought. Sean, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and get the latest on the Ruff Fire, which is burning near Kings Canyon National Park east of Fresno. Now over 21,000 acres. We'll talk to some folks at Hume Lake, which is at the center of the fight. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. Listening to Valley Edition. Walnuts are one of the highest value crops in California, bringing in almost $2 billion every year. But keeping the crop free of destructive insects can be costly. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, scientists are studying if walnut growers could reduce their pest control costs by employing hungry bats.
Sean McNamara is walking toward a white barn at his family's walnut orchards outside of Winters.
So here are three boxes.
He looks up about 15 feet at bat boxes attached to the side of the barn.
And this tiny box, 4 inches deep by 2 feet tall by 1 foot wide, can host a colony of up to 100 bats.
Bats eat insects, lots of them. One pregnant bat can consume two-thirds of her body weight in insects a night. McNamara says his bats provide free insect control for the orchards. The codling moth is particularly destructive. Its larvae can burrow inside the walnut.
When those walnuts go into grading at our processor handler, they will make a random sampling and downgrade you for large levels of codling moth. You could get up to 10% codling moth damage, which would be a significant financial hit.
Scientists want to learn how much bats might improve a walnut grower's bottom line, and there's only one way to determine a bat's consumption of codling moth.
We are here for glorified poo in a bag.
Catherine Ingram is a wildlife ecologist with UC Davis, and she's out to capture a bat.
We allow the bats to defecate in a bag so that we can test the guano sample for codling moth DNA.
In McNamara's orchard, Ingram and her grad students set up what looks like a badminton net with fine mesh netting. It allows them to catch the bat without hurting it. It's placed strategically in the orchard in what could be a bat flyway. At dusk, they wait. At the bat house, bats start to chatter. Then all at once, they fly out, and in no time, Ingram catches two bats.
There's a lot pouring out, though.
I know. I'm going to go ahead and grab them.
One gets really tangled in the net. Ingram talks to it like a mother, even though it's biting her.
Okay, buddy. All right. I know. Well, you got a good hunk of my knuckle.
This is a Mexican free-tail bat, which is one of the common ones. There we go.
It takes a while to get him out.
Okay. Now he can work on this side.
Did you get his wing out?
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Perfect. Good job.
Once free from the net, it's placed in a breathable Ziploc bag.
You are a warrior. You are a warrior, little bat. So this guy's angry. That guy's nice.
But soon, Ingram gets what she came for.
Angry bat gave us a poo.
Ingram determines the bat's sex, weight, and species. Then she lets it go. The guano will be sent off to the lab to test for codling moth DNA. But she can't capture every species. To really get an idea of how bats forage in walnut groves, she arms herself with a unique recorder.
These recorders can pick up bat calls from up to 10 meters away, so a 10-meter radius.
In another walnut orchard, Ingram carries a 10-foot pole with a recorder and microphone attached.
So I've chosen to put my unit up on a baby walnut.
Ingram says the recorder picks up 700 to 1,000 bat calls a night. The recordings in a software program called Sonobat help her determine what species are foraging.
Based on the recordings that I've already gotten, I think there's at least 10 species of bats using these orchards.
She puts the recorders in conventional and organic orchards of varying ages. Ultimately, she hopes to determine the financial benefits.
Bats eating codling moth may have a substantial enough impact to prevent one or two sprayings of pesticide per year.
Pesticides can cost some walnut farmers around $160 per acre per application. Ingram hopes to finish her research next year. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The Rough Fire, which is burning near Kings Canyon National Park east of Fresno, has now grown to nearly 21,000 acres. On Sunday, when the fire grew over 4,000 acres in one day alone, park officials closed Highway 180 east of Hume Lake, cutting off access to Cedar Grove and backcountry trails. Hume Lake is being used as a base of operation for fire crews, and the road to the lake remains open. Rugged and isolated terrain has made fighting the fire difficult, and fire crews say warm temperatures and dry air will increase fire activity and smoke in the region. And new this morning, the Fresno County Sheriff's Office has issued evacuation warning notices to people in the area of Black Rock Reservoir, which is east of Pine Flat Lake on the Sierra National Forest. Black Rock Campground can be a popular destination for visitors. It is now closed. A community meeting is scheduled for tonight at 6 p.m. at the Dunlap Community Center to talk about the current and expected activity of the fire. Representatives from the National Forest, National Park, and the Integrated Fire Management Team will be there to talk about the situation. Here to tell us more about what's going on right now, we have on the phone with us live Bob Moll. He is the fire chief for the Hume Lake Volunteer Fire and Rescue Department. Bob, welcome.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Doing well. What is the situation like from your vantage point right now in Hume Lake?
Currently, the Hume Lake Basin, we're experiencing some pretty smoky conditions in the morning. Yesterday, actually, the smoke never did clear, so we were in the smoke from the fire pretty much most of the day yesterday. The fire all along, the plan has been to keep it north of the Kings River, and we've actually, the crews have actually been able to do that. So right now, we're in a heightened alert. The sheriff has given us a condition of warning as far as evacuation, so all of the local residents and visitors in our area are under a warning at this point for evacuation.
So now, for listeners who might not be familiar with this particular part of the mountainous area in the Sierra near the National Park, Hume Lake is on the south side of this particular fork of the Kings River. The fire is on the other side of the river. So right now, the area is not threatened. Is that a correct assessment?
That's correct, other than we're in a real watchful condition right now. The fire is actually back down to the Kings River, north of the Kings River. So our concern would be that if it got to the south side, that the topography in the area would actually be conducive for the fire to move towards the Hume Lake Basin, and then that's when we would actually go into an evacuation mode and clear out the folks that are in this valley.
So right now, Hume Lake is a center of activity for the fire with fire crews. What exactly is going on in the area? I understand the camp there is pretty much done for the year. Overall, what's the situation? Are there still visitors? Is it just fire crews?
So right at the moment, we're hosting the Dave Cooper Incident Command Team on campus. We just finished our 10 weeks of summer camp last week, so we were thankful that the students that were visiting were safe the whole time, but we had a plan to get them out, but they're gone now. So during the fall season, we host a variety of other type of conferences up here on the campus. A couple of them have chosen to not come this next week because of the current conditions. But as we see a lot of fire activity on the campus, we have a lot of resources here on campus that are protecting the camp and other structures in the area. So the incident command team is doing well up on the hill here on campus, as well as firefighting resources around the campus.
This is a really rugged area, some difficult terrain, especially on that side of the river. There's not a lot of roads or other access into the area. How are the fire crews holding up with this heat and the terrain, all the challenges they face? You see them on a regular basis, and you know something about fighting fires. How are they doing?
Yeah, they're actually faring very well. There's a lot of support here right now as far as, you know, sleeping and food and things like that. So during the morning when they go out on the fire line, it's a tough day because, as you mentioned, it is quite rugged. But they come back in. They're very tired. They're able to get some rest at night. The night crews go out. As far as the firefighters go, they're doing well. As you can see, it's starting to wear on them. There's a lot of fires going on in the western region of the country right now. So resources are stretched pretty thin, but we're able to support them, at least on this incident, in a pretty good fashion. And I'm not seeing any adverse effects from at least a firefighter perspective in their working conditions and things like that.
That's great to hear. Before we go, what's the overall mood like as we've seen this fire grow rather substantially over the last few days? It's hot, it's dry. Are people optimistic that this is going to be something that crews can at least corral in some way, or are people starting to think this might get much bigger?
Right now, at least on our part of the fire, on the southern section of the fire, we have obviously, the local residents are very concerned, and we're trying to keep them as advised on the situation as we can. So we're starting to actually see some folks leaving the mountain just because of the smoke conditions and things like that. So we're in a heightened alert. We're seeing a lot of you know, folks that are they're gathering around our information points, and we're trying to keep them all informed. Hume Lake only has two ways in and out, so people are very aware of that. So they're just they're aware. We're cautiously optimistic. We're praying that the fire will stay north of the drainage there in the Kings River, and this will be behind us in a couple of days.
We certainly hope so. Our guest today, Bob Mole, he is the fire chief for the Hume Lake Volunteer Fire and Rescue Department, talking about the Rough Fire, which is now over 21,000 acres today, burning near Kings Canyon National Park east of Fresno. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. Have a good day.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Here's a little something that may make you feel, well, old. Remember a few years ago when UC Regents were scouting sites in the Valley for a new University of California campus? They looked at sites in Fresno near Academy and in Madera County, near where Valley Children's Hospital is today. Those sites lost out to a former golf course along Lake Yosemite just outside of Merced. Well, those debates took place 20 years ago. And it's been a full decade since UC Merced opened its doors to its first class of students. Back in 2005, the campus enrollment was just 875. Now it's over 6,000 students. And campus officials hope that number could grow to over 10,000 by the year 2020. There's one problem, though. Where to put all those people? Students, professors, support staff, research facilities all need space, an extra 1 million square feet. And in an era of new priorities in Sacramento, getting the money to pay for such an expansion is proving to be difficult. That's why our next guest is pitching an innovative strategy that she says will save the campus money and speed up the project to meet growing enrollment needs. Joining us now is UC Merced Chancellor Dorothy Leland. Chancellor Leland, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you for speaking with me today.
Before we talk about the expansion plans themselves, let's talk about the need, first of all. UC Merced has been around 10 years. To borrow terms from the private sector, what's the demand side of your business like right now in terms of students on campus and ones that, that want to come to UC Merced?
The demand side is very strong. For the last 2 years, we've had the largest percent increase in Native applicants to UC Merced. That's over every other campus in the University of California. So a Native applicant is an applicant, a freshman, and someone who lists UC Merced as one of their first choices.
And how do you see that growing in the future?
I see the demand continuing to be strong. We serve the demographic future of the state of California. The majority of our students are low-income, first-generation, and minority. And as you know, that is a significant population in the San Joaquin Valley as well.
So you've laid out a bold vision for having the infrastructure to accommodate this future growth on the UC Merced campus, and I want to talk about the specifics of that in a bit, but essentially you're asking the private sector to step up to design, finance, build, and even, as I understand, operate this expansion, which is pretty unusual or unconventional in the academic world. Why go that route?
Well, we don't have the more traditional paths available to us within the time frame or the cost parameters that we need to work under. So the kind of procurement that we're trying to use is one that gives us our buildings in the quickest amount of time for the lowest cost.
So exactly how would this process work? Do you put out bids to companies and they say, yeah, we'll build you a building and we'll finance it and do this? Do they work with you in terms of designing this? How does this process get from where you are today to 2020 when you have this ambitious goal?
Well, it is it's a single development partner that will put up all the buildings that we need for the campus to grow to 10,000 in two phases. So we will have academic and research buildings going up at the same time that we have residence halls going up. So part of what's unusual about this process is that we pay for this along the way. So there will be a contract that is approximately 30 years or so, and the private partner gets two kinds of payments. When clusters of buildings are up on time and to our specifications in the contract, they get paid what are called milestone payments. And then over the life of the contract, if those buildings continue to be available to us and up to the standards specified in the contract, then they get what are called availability payments. So it's also a different way of financing and paying for your buildings that is much easier for us to manage.
So if I understand what you're saying, is there's really two parts to this equation. Number one, the state resources that helped build other UC campuses in the past simply aren't there like they have been in other decades now. But you're also saying that this is more financially feasible. It's a better deal, essentially, for UC Merced to go this route?
It's a better deal for us to go this route. We know what it would cost us and how long it would take in a more traditional route. It would cost us about $1.1 billion. We, in our RFP process, we will have what's called an upset limit, and it will require competitive bids to come in below that amount. So we know that we can get it for less money than through the traditional process.
You mentioned that there's academic and other support buildings going up at the same time. Tell us a little more about what this expansion would actually mean for the campus itself. I understand you're expanding your capacity, but not as much your footprint. Why is that?
It saved us a considerable amount of money to develop the second phase of the campus on a smaller footprint. It saved us, as you remember, the initial campus is on top of a golf course. And to go any further than that golf course, we have significant infrastructure expansion that includes navigating irrigation canals. So we reduce the footprint in order to save millions and millions and millions of dollars in infrastructure costs. That reduced footprint for the second phase of the campus also meant that we couldn't build quite everything we needed here on the campus. And so part of this project is also to build administrative support to focus that in downtown Merced, which we believe will really have economic redevelopment benefits for that area of our community.
And the Regents and the City of Merced have recently signed off on that new $45 million downtown center. What activities are going to be housed there, and how big of a role do you see that is playing in UC Merced's involvement in the community?
Well, I think it will play a significant role because we're going to have a much bigger presence in the downtown area. It will allow us to much more effectively partner with entities that are already in the downtown. For example, we don't have to duplicate really wonderful performing and visual arts venues that are already in downtown Merced. We can form partnerships, and it will strengthen those entities, and it will strengthen the university. We'll have people who are patrons of all the small businesses that are downtown, so that will bring retail revenue into the downtown area. So I think it will over time have significant benefits to downtown Merced. The building will mainly house administrative staff, but we've also created the downtown floor to be a floor for both students and for the community. We know that a number of our students live in the downtown area, and so there'll be places for them to study and hang out. We will have some classrooms there. We plan to start extended education for the community, and we can deliver that in those classrooms.
And another project as part of the things that UC Merced is doing downtown, you have a business accelerator as part of the Small Business Development Center that's relocating there and expanding. What role will that play right now? What's happening?
Well, we think this is all part of the picture of UC Merced's presence in the downtown, which gives us, I think, a greater presence and impact in the community. The Small Business Development Center, as you know, can provide critical help to small businesses in their startup and expansion phases. So that will be more readily available to businesses in our community. And then the other part of this is we now have a space and a formal process for trying to take the best ideas of our student and faculty to the marketplace. And as you know, that's one of the distinctive functions of a research university is to, when it can, is to take inventions and turn those inventions into things that make a difference in the world.
We're talking to UC Merced Chancellor Dorothy Leland on Valley Edition today about the campus's expansion plans. There's been a lot of talk about the UC system, its state support for UC overall, and you even mentioned when we started our conversation today about the changing demographics in California. You've spoken at length about this issue and the role you feel UC Merced will play, especially being here in one of the areas of the state that's going to undergo a lot of change in the future as growth takes place here in the Central Valley. How does UC Merced and your vision for the campus fit in with the overall demands for higher education at the UC and the demands that the Valley will place on the need for higher education?
I believe that the University of California sees us as absolutely central to the ability of the university to meet enrollment demands in the future. It's part of the reason that we were built. It's a good part of the reason that the Office of the President will be making significant contributions to the funding of the second phase of the development of the campus.
And as we look ahead on the timeline, you've set a 2020 goal for this project. 2016 is almost here. It sounds like a tight timeline. Where is this project right now in terms of moving forward? What does the timeline look like?
Well, our timeline is we have our first formal approval process in November at the Board of Regents meeting, and that process will involve the approval of the release of a request for proposals. We've gone through a preliminary process where we have three entities who are in competition and that we expect to respond to the request for proposals. We are on an extraordinarily tight timeline, but so far we've been hitting our marks.
And assuming that this project is as successful as you and the others who are working on it so diligently believe, do you feel this is going to be maybe a new model for other California campuses, whether at the UC or CSU? Is this something that other people are paying attention to?
I do. Other people are paying attention. It's a model that has been used. It's fairly new. In the public sector for public works projects, such as courthouses and bridges and but it has not been used in higher education, and so we have a lot of eyes watching us, including eyes in the CSU and in the UC.
UC Merced Chancellor Dorothy Leland joining us today to talk about her expansion plans for the UC Merced campus, reaching a goal of doubling the campus's physical capacity by the year 2020, partnering with the private sector in order to design, build, finance, and operate that project. Chancellor Leland, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. A few weeks ago on our program, we told you about the kickoff of events and activities as part of something called Hmong Story 40, the 40th anniversary of the resettlement of the Hmong people to America. Now there's a new event coming up this Saturday. It's taking place at Fresno City College. It's called The History Behind the Hmong Refugee Exodus. It's a discussion featuring some people who were very influential in this process, bringing them together for the first time, folks from the U.S. State Department and others in the Hmong community, celebrating and discussing the historic events of 40 years ago. Joining us now in our studio, we have Lar Yang with the Hmong Story 40 Project. Welcome back to Valley Edition.
Yes, thank you for having me again. And I want to thank Valley Public Radio for the opportunity to, you know, to present our project again.
This is really interesting because so often in history, many cases, years go by, people are no longer with us and can't recall their stories, aren't here to share their discussions about what happened so many years ago. In this case, you have brought together five of the people who were critically influential in the story of the Hmong people in the refugee camps and resettling in America, who really made this project happen, and telling us about the history of the Hmong people and how they wound up here in the U.S. How did this event come together?
Well, I mean, we're very fortunate that this circumstances actually unfolded and condensed together very, very well. We would have never expected to even, you know, be able to access these people. But I think that they had thought that the time had come because the history, particularly related to this chapter of the Hmong Exodus, it's never been really discussed before. I don't think I've ever read it in textbooks or any kind of, you know, college resources. So this is in the community as well. I don't think that many of them have heard about the groundwork that it took to secure, you know, the ability for them to immigrate to the United States. So
these are not household names for most of our listeners, but tell us a little bit about who the people that you have on this panel are and what role they played, and then we'll talk a little more about the history itself.
Wonderful. Our keynote speaker would be Lionel Rosenbelt, and then what he was the head of U.S. State Department based out of D.C., and then he oversaw the whole refugee crisis in Thailand from about 1975 until he left his position. It was a couple years, but he was the head of State Department, and he was tasked with, you know, overseeing the whole project on that. But beneath him was Mack Thompson, and Mack Thompson was his first person on the ground. Below him, if you know a little bit of Hmong history, then Jerry Daniels worked underneath him, and then everything else kind of fanned out from that. So these are the most critical people within that the context of that history.
And you also have people from Southeast Asia as well.
Yes.
Who are part of this panel.
So we have two Thai gentlemen, Suchai and Noi. And what they were the bridge between the Thai government and the U.S. government. So they were on the ground representing the Thai Minister of Interior, working with the U.S. government on you know, how do we secure land, how do we resolve all these issues between the different refugees. So they're all very, very critical. Galen Berry worked underneath Pop Beal. So Pop Beal was very, very significant within the context of that history, and Galen Berry was his right-hand man.
So tell us a little bit in this. We don't have a whole lot of time to document the entire story here, but the role of the Hmong people and what happened in those years in Laos, in Thailand, and the secret war. How did the Hmong people come to be in this situation where they no longer had a homeland?
Yes. Well, you know, the whole conflict in Laos was because they were trying to prevent communists to spread all throughout Southeast Asia and to collapse all of Southeast Asia into the communist influence. So Thailand was pushing really hard to support Laos so that Laos wouldn't collapse. And then, you know, the whole United Nations agreed to make Laos a neutral territory. That was the Geneva Accord. What happened with the war was that a lot of it was in Military Region 2, and then that was kind of the highlands where all the Hmong and the minorities lived across some routes, you know, the major routes. So the Hmong ended up having to defend their homeland, which was the area that they lived in, with the help of the CIA, you know, coming in and helping all that stuff there. And then what happened was...
And this is the clandestine CIA
yes.
operation known as the Secret War.
Secret War, yes. And so that's the root of that stuff there. You know, Long Chang, which is the major base during the Secret War, it fell a couple weeks after the fall of Saigon. So there, we don't connect that what was happening in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge and what was happening in Vietnam to the secret war, but it's all one conflict. And so after the fall of Saigon, Longshang is evacuated, and then where did the Hmong people go? And so General Vang Pao and his whole close circle, they were evacuated to Thailand. And so this is what these folks will talk about, you know, the last days of Laos. When the plane left and Vang Pao and his close circle arrived in Thailand, what happened? You know, and then when the refugees started appearing on the shores of Thailand, what happened? And basically what happened was that Vietnam – America knew about Vietnam, and then they knew about Cambodia, and they had a plan, a contingency plan to help those people, but they didn't have a plan for the Hmong because of the secret war. It was classified, you know. And then these people had to jump on the ground and say, what are all these other people doing here? And then, you know, the Hmong and the Lao, and then they had to really think on their feet and restructure a lot of the immigration policy to allow the Hmong to come to the States.
Those will some of the history. That's just some of the history that will be discussed at this event taking place at Fresno City College, the City College Theater, Saturday at 10:30. Well, it starts at 10:30 and goes to 4. The program of speakers is from, I gather, 11 till 3.
Yes.
This is one of a number of things that are taking place as part of Hmong Story 40. In addition to the panel on Saturday, you'll have a slideshow, exhibit preview. That is a preview of the exhibit that's going to be taking place
yes,
later this year.
Yes, it's just to kind of give a little small preview of some of the components of our 40th year project exhibition. So not a lot of it, just some of it, so people get an idea of what the work that we're working towards.
Looking at the poster that you have, I see a lot of different organizations have signed on. It seems like more even than when you were here last a few months ago. What has the community response been, both in the Hmong community and even beyond in taking part in this occasion?
You know, I think it is it's very, very critical, especially in cities like Fresno and Sacramento. You know, if you think of the history of the Valley, I mean, it's we've been here long enough to actually play a critical role in the history of the Valley. So along the way, the last 30 years or so, we've built a lot of partnerships with different things. And I think that they understand that, you know, America is a country of immigrants, and we are kind of the most recent wave. And, you know, to celebrate and to learn about this specific community and their migration and their struggles as a refugee, it is an American story. You know, I think other people can kind of reflect back on their own and celebrate, you know, their own uniqueness, but also understand and connect that, you know, we are all part of the same process. And it's the richness of different cultures and communities that really enhance the riches of the Valley.
And it's a part of our local history, a part of our nation's history, a part of 20th century history that in some ways hasn't been all that documented. And some of the people who were actually there making the decisions and helping this process unfold, the Hmong exodus to the United States, will be at Fresno City College on Saturday sharing their stories for the first time together in one room. Again, it's the event titled The History Behind the Hmong Refugee Exodus. It's a panel discussion and more at City College. Lar Yang, our guest today. Lar, if people want information on this, what should they do?
You know, they can go to the website, Hmongstory40.org, and then they can check it out there as well. Or they can call, you know, my office, which is 559-454-1212 for any kind of information or questions like that. I think this is a very, very important, critical event in history in general because a lot of these gentlemen are in their late 70s to 80s. They're compromised health as well. I mean, it's just time to really document it. And I invite everybody to attend because they will experience living history. You know, it's a very, very unique opportunity.
Great. We wish you the best of luck as the events go on. Lar Yang, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. Let us know your thoughts. You can email us talk@kvpr.org or tweet us @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.